The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
The World War II podcast is made possible from the kind donations of listeners like yourself. There are thousands of you out there. If each one of you gave a dollar or two a month, it would really help me to improve the show for you. Go to patreon.com/WW2podcast and have a poke about. You'll see a short video of me explaining it all. And for those who become patrons of the show, I do try to give a bit extra back with outtakes and off-topic chat with contributors. Hello and welcome to another World War II podcast. I don't know how many of you are aware, but I also do the Ancient Warfare magazine podcast. Chatting with regular Mark DeSantis, he told me his other expertise was the Second World War, and he'd just written an article for a magazine on the Rhine crossings. The Rhine crossings have always interested me. I have a book on my bookshelf I bought years ago, sat unread on my shelf. This seemed like an ideal opportunity to dust it off. So I asked Mark if he'd like to come on and talk World War II. So Mark, thanks for joining me. I think you're keen to start with a look at logistics.
What we find during the Second World War is whatever the desires of various commanders to make big, bold strokes, grab territory, it was all predicated upon having a viable logistics chain, a supply line, to bring ammunition, food, fuel up to the troops at the front. That was very hard to do. The entire North Africa campaign, they call it the Seesaw Campaign, tended to be one army succeeding, driving the other back until the winning army outraced its supply lines. The losing army was pushed back on its own supply lines, managed to halt them and then knock them back. And the process reversed itself. What we see happening in Northwest Europe beginning 1944. So the DDE landings occur and they made enormous efforts to bring supplies not merely in through various ports, but all especially directly onto the beach. They had first those Mulberry harbors, and then when the Mulberry harbors were destroyed in a storm, they would just unload the supplies right onto the beach in Normandy. Once the Normandy campaign was over and the Mortain counterattack had been repulsed and Paris was taken, the Anglo-American troops advancing through France, they were outrunning their supply lines substantially. What was going on in France in the summer and early autumn of 1944 was a pursuit. That is, the Germans were retreating quickly, and the U.S. and British forces were trying to keep up the pressure on those retreating Germans. What was happening is that the further they got from Normandy, the more difficult it was to keep the advanced spearheads of their armies supplied with fuel. So, for example, the U.S. Army instituted something called the Red Ball Express, which were a series of truck convoys with priority for usage of all roads. But they were burning more fuel than they were ever delivering to the U.S. tanks, for instance. That was not a sustainable means of keeping up the campaign. The reason I bring this up is Allied strategy in 1944 seemed to become overly optimistic in the wake of the collapse of the German defenses in France after the Normandy campaign. That is, from Eisenhower on down, many generals seemed to believe that it would be possible to knock the Germans out of the war by the end of 1944. They could be inside Germany and grab Berlin, what have you. But I think problematically, it underestimated first the power of German recuperative powers. The German army demonstrated time and again the ability to pick itself off the mat, dust itself off, and fight back very hard. For example, a famous example of this actually was on the Eastern Front after Stalingrad, von Manstein, he had his so-called backhand blow, which restored the front for the most part in early 1943 in combat with the Soviets. Also, I think it was wildly optimistic to believe that somehow that using a handful of supply entry points in Normandy, that you were going to make one big lunge across France all the way to Germany and knock Germany out of the war. One of the things that you find in every campaign in World War II is that there was a natural limit to how far even the most successful drive could go from its initial supply line. So even if your supply lines were right behind the front, eventually they're going to be too far away to keep your leading element supplied. The enemy would somehow dig in at that edge, maybe strike back, what have you. It was too many hundreds of miles for that to be ended so quickly. So we get to, and this is leading up to the question of the Rhine crossings, we get to the point where, how do you go about invading Germany itself? Eisenhower had supported the idea of giving priority to Montgomery and his 21st Army Group's drive into northern Germany. They had a relative straight line going into the North German plain, which would then encircle the Ruhr, which had the preponderance of Germany's industry. That makes a lot of sense. That was one of the reasons why Eisenhower had okayed Operation Market Garden, the idea that you're going to lay down a carpet of airborne troops, seize bridges over several rivers and canals, get across the Rhine, and that would somehow be something of like the, if not the death blow to Germany, close to it.
A knife thrust into the heart.
Right, right. it did not end as, for example, as there's all sorts of postmortems you could do for Operation Market Garden. It seems that if any of those bridges crossings failed, and they did ultimately at Arnhem, then the operation failed. The German army demonstrated that it had the ability to react quickly and hit back hard against overextended Allied thrusts. It left the Allies looking for, not in possession of a Rhine crossing in September, as they would hoped. It also, and this was not just a problem that the 21st Army Group in Holland experienced, but also there was fighting elsewhere where as you closed up against the German border, the Germans managed to dig in. So the U.S. had a hell of a time fighting in the Herndon Forest. The pursuit across France came to an end along the German border. That made sense there. They started fighting harder for German territory. The Rhine, therefore, it's the major geographic barrier between Germany and the rest of Europe. It's a very defensible line. Crossing the Rhine then became a very big deal, how they were going to do it, to show you also that German recuperative powers were extraordinary. The Wehrmacht was able to put together the massive offensive in the Ardennes, hit the U.S. Troops that were not looking for anything, right? They were there to rest. Many of them had actually been transferred from the debacle that was the Herndon Forest battle. They were taken completely by surprise. One of the reasons why the surprise was so effective was that prior to the Germans pulling back into German territory, they were using the Enigma machines to send most of their coded messages. The Enigma machines were compromised by the messages by Ultra, right? So that's the Bletchley Park decoding operations. It was giving the Allied commanders a real-time look into what was going on inside the German high command. What happened once the Germans had pulled inside of Germany was that when they were doing most of their planning for the Ardennes offensive, is that they were actually using telephones, not the Enigma machines, over radio. This is something that Ultra is going to miss completely because these are not radio interceptable radio messages. Once the Ardennes offensive takes place and it's finally stopped and pushed back, Eisenhower no longer trusts what he's being told by his own people at Ultra, Schaeff, and they became very cautious about some new surprise from the Germans, and that would affect their strategy going into 1945.
What I find curious is, when you look at Eisenhower's strategy for Northwest Europe, everyone talks about the broad front strategy, and Patton's, you know, notoriously railed against it. We're not getting enough fuel. He felt he'd have more fuel. Yeah, all of a sudden, Montgomery's given his head to make this thrust for the Rhine in with Market Garden. He's leaping forward, and it suddenly flies in the face of the broad front strategy. What's interesting, what you just pointed out, you know, I wonder if there was an optimism, let's just get it done before Christmas, let's just break through. But the funny thing is, even after that, and we're into 45, the curiously, one would have thought with the broad front strategy, you would plan large scale crossings along the length of the Rhine. Yet this idea of just concentrating on that northern sector, why was it the place to cross in the north and rather than possibly the less well defended south?
The impression that I get,
and it's thinner south, it'd be an easy crossing.
Right. Well, the impression that I get is that with the British and Canadian armies in the north, they had the most direct route into the North German plain, you know, flat ground, and they would encircle the Ruhr from the north. For example, Patton was upset that he was not getting the supplies that he needed. But I don't know if they could have gotten him the supplies that he wanted at all, because of the supply difficulties were not a question of necessarily of choice, but they were just too far from their ports in Normandy. So once again, the idea that you were going to, you know, just roll your way into Germany in 1944, it seemed overly optimistic. And part of that was occasioned by the fact that the German army had collapse in France, but did reform itself and put up a viable defense once it got back to, you know, roughly close to the German border. Eisenhower had always supported, as part of his broad front strategy, he wanted to give priority to the 21st Army Group to go into northern Germany and capture the Ruhr. But also, he wanted that to be done alongside, you know, only once the Allied armies to the south. So, for example, there was Bradley's 12th Army Group, which had 1st U.S. Army and 3rd U.S. Army. That was Patton's army. 1st U.S. Army was commanded by General Courtney Hodges. Before they had, he didn't want anybody to cross until everybody had sidled up to the Rhine. And it also included Alexander Patch's 6th U.S. Army, which had landed in southern France. The battles to simply take the Rhineland on the western side of the Rhine were tough. The Germans opened up some of the dams, flooded the land in front of Montgomery's armies.
That's Veritable, Operation Veritable.
Right, Operation Veritable, very difficult. In fact, it was largely an amphibious operation. It was almost like watching the U.S. Marines, you know, going ashore at Iwo Jima. They were using many of the Buffalo Amtraks and Duck W's. It slowed things down quite a lot. What happens when you come to the Rhine crossings is, if you start with the north, the strongest German opposition was opposite Montgomery's 21st Army Group. He was planning to make his crossing at Wesel. The surprise came, so it's March 7th, 1945. So this is after the Ardennes offensive had been stopped.
And Montgomery's schedule for the 22nd and 23rd and 24th of March. So we're still a few weeks before.
Yes. So this is about 2 weeks ahead of time. Courtney Hodges' 1st U.S. Army had launched something called Operation Lumberjack. Now, that was their version of Veritable. 9th Army in between, which was under the 21st Army Group, that was the U.S. 9th Army, they launched Operation Grenade. That got them to the Rhine. Operation Lumberjack was 1st U.S. Army's operation to get to the Rhine itself. They were simply expecting to come up to the Rhine and then have to deal with a crossing themselves. But what they discovered on March 7th at Remagen was the intact Ludendorff Bridge. It was a railroad bridge, very sturdy, and defended, but not heavily defended by German troops. German troops, they found, were still retreating over this bridge. It had not been blown. Every other bridge across the Rhine had been destroyed by that time, not this bridge. And one of the reasons why it hadn't been destroyed yet was, first, they didn't expect that the U.S. First Army was going to make such a rapid advance. We're still waiting for other German troops to get back across. The bridge had been wired for demolition, just the orders had not been given to bring it down. And this is one of those things where, you know, you talk about U.S. First Army, you know, finds this bridge intact. It came down to a few platoons of U.S. Soldiers and some engineers that accompanied them to seize the initiative, race across. All right. As they're crossing, the Germans detonated some of the explosives. They wanted to detonate all of them, but only one of the charges went off. So the U.S. troops are there thinking, this is it. We're going down. Once the dust settles, they see the bridge is still up there. They race across from Remagen, across the bridge to Erpel, which is on the other side of the Rhine. And they capture both sides. One of the mysteries about why the bridge didn't go down was that possibly some of the circuits had, the wires have been damaged. So not all of the, there was certainly enough explosive to take down the bridge. They may have been damaged by U.S. bombing. There may have been sabotage. Also, the explosive used was something called Donerit, which is a commercial explosive, which was not quite as powerful as military-grade high explosive. So the upshot was is there's the demolition explosion, and it fails. So the Americans across the other side, within a day, they put about 8,000 soldiers over the Rhine, and the Germans reacted. Hitler was not happy.
The German reaction is somewhat fierce.
Right. Well, the thing is that the German defense of the bridge and their failure to destroy the bridge had several causes, but one of them was confusion as to command. That is, the officer who was supposed to command the bridge, he received command that morning. There was a confusion as to command as to whether or not the bridge was responsibility was in the hand of the military district. Germany itself was divided into something called Wehrkreis, which were military districts. So the German army officer actually got command of Remagen, got it that day. He was 35 miles away when he was given command. And he was actually about twice as far from the bridge as the Americans were once he saw that morning. So he had to race there, figure out what was going on. Nothing went right for him. And once the Americans had the bridge in their possession, they did everything they could to defend their bridgehead and the bridge itself. With this, I guess you would call it a windfall of an intact bridge, or I say intact, it had been damaged, but it was still standing. The Germans made every effort they could to try and take it back. They fired artillery at it. They unleashed jets, the Messerschmitt ME-262s. They used the Arado 234 jets to try and hit it. Everything missed.
First use of strategic use of V2 of ballistic weapons on the bridge, and they were a failure.
Right. I think 12 V2 missiles were launched from sites in Holland against the bridge, but they were just not accurate enough to do anything. Two of the missiles struck, but nothing came closer than a mile to the bridge. Germans deployed Frogmen to try and stop this.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting maneuver.
They were all spotted before they got close. The Luftwaffe, conventional aircraft Luftwaffe, they were also used Stukas, FW-190s. They were all shot down. The Americans just put anti-aircraft batteries up there. One of the officers said that whenever a Luftwaffe aircraft would appear in the sky, he called it $1 million minute, because that's how much ammunition was being expended to take down one aircraft. The tracer just lit up the sky, turned the sky pink.
I've read references somewhere of the air guns were lined up bumper to bumper.
It's essentially the most common vehicle would have been the M3 half tracks with the quad 50 caliber machine guns on them. They said, don't even bother trying to identify what the aircraft is. If you see an airplane, shoot it down, which they did. The main damage to the bridge, interestingly enough, came via, I'm going to call it conventional artillery, not the giant siege mortars, but artillery fired from the German side, which managed to destroy on the bridge a truck carrying ammunition, and also I think a fuel truck. Because of the ammunition truck goes up, blows a hole in the bridge, the fuel truck is hit, and that stops traffic along the bridge for some time. However, while all of this was going on, U.S. engineers had managed to throw up some tactical bridges. They put up a pontoon bridge. They put up also a bailey bridge. And so the Ludendorff Bridge itself, you know, still very valuable, but there were ways to get onto the other side to reinforce the bridgehead. Finally, the bridge collapses on March 17th. You know, it had been weakened so desperately. Once that happens, though, it was not quite as critical as it was maybe a week before.
Well, they've got 25,000 men over in the first 6 days. It has always made me consider why they didn't push harder there and then maybe not bother with the later operations to the north, because they're already over. But
good reason, though, for there was going to have to be bridging operations in every army sector. I mean, you just couldn't pour everything through the Remagen bridgehead. There wasn't, for example, you couldn't have shifted all of 21st Army Group down to Remagen. So someone was going to have to make a crossing in their sector. Certainly, the Remagen crossing was very valuable in that it opened up different possibilities by having substantial U.S. forces on that side in that sector. It made a shallow envelopment of the German 15th Army possible. Instead of having to swing very deeply into the Ruhr to encircle, a shallower envelopment was made possible. The terrain on the other side of the Rhine, on the eastern side of the Rhine, was not the most favorable for exploitation by armored forces. It was forested, it was hilly, so it was not ideal that way. That being said, they had the bridge, they were across, and you know, you fight where you have to fight.
I read somewhere the US troops were the first enemy to cross the Rhine since Napoleon, and before that, now this is where I'm not take this with a pinch of salt, but before that, Julius Caesar.
Really? That is interesting, certainly. That would not surprise me. I'm trying to think back to battles going into maybe the 16th century or possibly...
It gets more difficult, doesn't it? Because you're not necessarily dealing with a unified Germany, and where were people in the various wars and bits and pieces. But it got me thinking.
What did Marlborough do? I don't know. Someone may have been fighting somewhere. I don't know if... did the Duke of Parma ever cross the Rhine? I'll have to research that.
But that also brings me to something else, which had a mention somewhere. I think it's one of the ancient warfare podcasts about the Minden Gap. I mean, to the north. I mean, the northern route is the traditional route where Monty was going in and out of that area, as you were saying, because the terrain's more favourable, being flat and not upland terrain.
Well, Gap also, it's relatively close to the Teutoburger Wald, which is where General Varus and his legions ran and were destroyed by Arminius in the Teutoburg Forest. I think that if we did some digging, we might find someone who had crossed the Rhine. I'm thinking, did Germanicus cross the Rhine too? Maybe he was across there. But it sounds great to say the first soldiers since Napoleon, and before that, Julius Caesar.
I could agree with possibly with Napoleon, but then it's such a big gap that that somehow seems to have been someone else. Montgomery seems to take the news quite magnanimously, surprisingly, that someone had stolen his thunder 2 or 3 weeks before.
I think that having Allied troops cross the Rhine is valuable because it would have taken pressure off Montgomery's own crossing it by draining German troops away to contain the Remagen bridgehead. One of the things that was going on is that there was such a high concentration of German forces opposed to the 21st Army Group at Wesel that it did make the crossing more difficult in terms of preparation, making sure that he had enough firepower to make a successful landing on the eastern bank of the Rhine. There's a lot of one-upmanship among the Allied commanders. For example, when Patton got up to the Rhine, he put troops across the day before, and then he called Bradley, his superior in the 12th U.S. Army Group, and said, "Listen, Bradley, I'm across the Rhine. Don't tell anybody, okay? Germans don't know we're there yet." But, you know, he wanted Bradley to release the information the next day to steal the thunder from Montgomery. And, you know, the high command of the Allies, there was a lot of personality clashes there.
Patton's crossing is almost laughable because he crosses down by at Oppenheim, is it near Mainz? They just row across almost unopposed.
Right. They went across. One of the benefits of, if the other side isn't, bank isn't defended, and you have the ability to press on quickly to seize an opportunity, that was patent for you. You know, he had the wherewithal to get his men moving. He did the right thing by getting across when he could. I think that that's the thing about Patton, is that his drive was always there. He had an army that was ready to obey his commands and fight aggressively on his behalf. And his staff work was, generally speaking, very good. The staff that he had, they were ready to, capable of getting that army moving quickly with a minimum of confusion and fuss.
I think I made a note that they got across with just 28 killed.
Right.
In their crossing, which is just remarkable, and they found almost no resistance. I suspect that the capturing the Remagen Bridge, the big thing was to withdraw forces from everywhere to try and contain the Americans that had come over there.
This also leads into a question of the nature of the German defenses along the Rhine. The German army was in a bad state in March 1945. It had not collapsed completely, but it was sorely depleted by the damage that it had taken during the Ardennes offensive. The formations that the Germans had were all, you know, if they were not skeleton formations, they were down to maybe 50%, you know, effectives. They were simply not, there was a lot of confusion, as I mentioned earlier, about just who was in charge and where. It was very difficult for them to make a cohesive defense across the length of the Rhine frontier, especially when you had this surprise bridgehead captured at Remagen. It certainly did make Patton's job easier. There was also, later on, there was a crossing by U.S. 7th Army that was part of Patch's 6th Army group that was down, I want to say, at Mannheim. So they were able to cross relatively easily. Okay, because, you know, German resistance was not strong.
I did make a note of that. They didn't quite have it all the way. Then the 24th and 25th, near Reims, two attempts failed. On the 26th, the US 6th Army crossed at Mannheim, you're right. But only after the Americans had fired 10,000 rounds of counter-battery fire to force the crossing.
This is at Mannheim?
Yeah.
Wow.
So they got a bit stuck, but that, you know, Patton's over. We've now, you know, now over in two places, which takes us, I guess, to plunder and varsity on the 24th and 25th of March. Something else I'd read when I was buffing up the date for varsity and plunder was set by the fact that the Rhine floodplain, they were pretty much sure, would be problematic until the end of March. Because the ground was dry, but they were pretty, because it's well drained, they were pretty sure that by that date it would be fine for a crossing, which is something else that, when you're looking at enthusiasm for finishing the war before Christmas of 44, and they started planning the Rhine crossings quite early. I've made a note, I read that just before I got you, and I made that anyway. They must have known that they would come into this sort of problem. So when they were enthusiastically thinking that it would be all over by Christmas, someone must not have pointed out the possible terrain problems in the damp conditions in the floodplain.
Well, it certainly seems that it should have been not just in the Rhine region, but, you know, across Holland, that one of the German responses would have been to, you know, open the dams, open the dikes, flood the area, make the terrain more difficult to cross. And also that the Rhine itself is a big river. You know, it was not going to be easy to get across it in one fell swoop. You know, they would have to have built up their supplies and, you know, brought up all the equipment that they would need. The crux of plunder varsity was that, and probably plunder, that was the river crossing operation that succeeded. The major controversy that surrounds plunder varsity is the varsity aspect. That was the airborne landings. Two divisions, British 6th Airborne and the American 17th Airborne Divisions were both part of Operation Varsity. Here's the interesting thing about Varsity. The Airborne Divisions were supposed to capture the bridges on the east side of the Rhine River, bridges over the Ischl. I'm sorry if I'm saying that wrong. They succeeded. But the interesting thing about Varsity is that the operation succeeded. They had learned from the mistakes that had been made during Operation Market Garden. So Operation Market Garden, because of a relative lack of transport, they had made the drops in two waves. With Varsity, everything was going to go at once. But they also said, well, we can't drop the airborne troops and have them on the other side and not be certain that we can come to their rescue. Okay. So interestingly, unlike what had happened with the airborne landings in Normandy or Market Garden, the airborne landings for Varsity took place only after plunder, the waterborne crossings, had succeeded. They were also took place all in daylight. The area around Wesel, where Monty's troops were crossing, was heavily defended by flak. So you have, in broad daylight, you have these C-47 Skytrains, the C-46 Commando aircraft, and they're tugging gliders. They're all big, slow targets, and they were shot to pieces. Lots of casualties. The gliders themselves were either hit while in the air, or some of them were hit on the ground. They discovered also that the C-46 Commando didn't have self-sealing fuel tanks. So those things just, if they were hit, they went up. So the problem with Varsity, and this is the Varsity controversy, is was it necessary to have the airborne component of the river crossing at all? I haven't come to a conclusion about that yet. And here is why. On the one hand, when you would drop airborne forces as part of an operation, say at Normandy or Operation Market Garden, linking up with those airborne troops, rescuing them, in fact, because the airborne troops just don't have any heavy equipment. They can't fight off tanks. It almost became an end in and of itself. If they were too far away, you ran the risk of having the parachute troops shot to pieces before you could get them. And it's probably not the best strategy to put your troops so far away that rescuing them is the main goal of your campaign, whereas the main goal of your operation ought to be achieving whatever the objectives are. But it's only natural that you have thousands of troops behind enemy lines. Let's go save them. With Varsity, it seems that in order to ensure that they would be rescued and not left to be annihilated by the Germans, that they had to wait until daylight, all right, and they were sure that the plunder crossings had succeeded. It does call into question, well, why do you need the airborne landings if the river crossing has already succeeded? Okay, right. Shouldn't the airborne landings be the support, the adjunct to the river crossings? And I'm of two minds on that. On the one hand, I mean, this is like the counterfactuals. The hindsight's always 20/20. If the river crossings of plunder had failed, Montgomery would certainly have been asked. They would have questioned him. Well, why didn't you use airborne troops to draw off German strength from defending at the riverbank? Okay. Whereas, because the river crossings did succeed, and there was heavy casualties among the airborne forces, not annihilated, by the way, but just heavy casualties, there comes into question, well, were they really necessary? It would seem to me that Montgomery was in a difficult position. If he uses the troops to ensure that the crossing succeeds, he's opened up to, well, why did you use them at all? By sending them in daylight. On the other hand, if they're not used, he might have been taken a task for risking the crossings themselves. Because I can imagine what would have happened if the river crossings had failed and they'd lost, say, 5,000 to 10,000 men in the river crossings back at square one. I haven't come to a decision yet about that.
See, I sort of evolved of 16,000 airborne troops put in. And it's an astronomical number. And I've assumed that the Allied airborne operations had never quite passed off very well. Sicily was not fabulous. Market Garden obviously had its problems. D-Day was not massively effective. And if you're crossing, you know, they were approaching it like a D-Day operation. They expected it, you know, it to be a big set piece. But if you're, and they go over in two waves very quickly, if you dump 16,000 men in a very short space period of time in enemy territory, you've got six, at the end of the day, you've got 16,000 men or whoever gets there. I think heavy casualties, 2,000 maybe were shot down by AA. So you've still got 14,000. And then you obviously got to take the percentage off of those who are in the wrong area. They're all over the place. But irrespective, you've got a lot of men dumped. When actually, if you're trying to bring them over in waves in boats, it's probably still slower than dump, you know, throwing them out of the planes. And so it all just adds to the mix. But it does seem overkill.
The question of overkill for the varsity component of the crossing, that's essentially the big criticism since 1945. And you raise a great question about the use of airborne troops. Are airborne troops supposed to be used on the scale of whole divisions dropping behind enemy lines? Or should they be more appropriately used in smaller formations to capture, you know, pinpoint targets such as Pegasus Bridge in the Normandy invasion? What's the purpose of them? When it comes to the Normandy invasion, you had three airborne divisions committed. It seems to me that because of the absolutely critical need to succeed, that is, you could not do D-Day again, okay? You were not getting a second chance for D-Day, that landing three entire divisions, now they landed pretty much all over the place, especially the U.S. airborne troops. Very few of them landed where they should have. They were also jumping at night, but putting them all across the Normandy battle space did have the advantage of sowing confusion among the Germans, stopping them from counterattacking, at least in the kind of force that they would have needed to, have a realistic chance of throwing back the seaborne landings. And in that regard, I think that the Normandy airborne operations were appropriate. They took a lot of casualties, that's only to be expected, but it was worth it. But once you start getting into Market Garden, where you have divisions strewn far from the ground forces, which are there to link up with them, you start getting into the question of, well, if you have, you know, several divisions now strung out all along, essentially surrounded, is that really the best use of airborne troops? Because, you know, as I said before, airborne troops, they can't fight tanks. They were promised that they would have to hold for 2, maybe 3 days, and it turned out to be a lot longer. So the Allies did learn their lesson from the problems of Market Garden. On the other hand, the lesson that they learned was, well, make all the jumps at once in daylight, but that exposed them to other problems. And it might have been a better idea if, for example, if there was a truly critical feature that they should have captured on the other side of the Rhine, that then maybe a small group of airborne troops would have been better, but maybe not two whole divisions.
Well, that's arguably a point that the Germans had figured out. They didn't do, you have to create, they never did any big drops, but they had great success at the start of this war with their small operations.
Right.
And it's noticeable that was the last great, Varsity was the last great airborne parachute operation in history. It was also the largest,
right. It was the largest.
But there was no more. And admittedly, there's other reasons for that. Helicopters, you know, sort of come in and steal the show. But, you know, clearly, as we say, it was problematic.
Sure, the danger of the vulnerability of gliders, especially. Also, just the trouble is that it's difficult to land men by parachute in the right place, especially at night. But if you go by, you fly them in at daylight, juicy, slow-moving target. The gliders themselves, once they're let go, I mean, they're just going in, you know, very slowly. They were hit. And each time those gliders are hit, or one of those C-47s or C-46 commandos is hit, there are dozens of men, possibly, who are going to be killed. I think you have to play make this judgment call. And it is a judgment call for a commander. If the success of this operation is so critical that sacrificing the lives of your parachute troops is acceptable, okay, acceptable loss, then that's something that Montgomery had to make if it actually worked. The problem with Varsity is that there's a logical flaw there in that the riverine crossings, okay, had already succeeded by the time that the Varsity landing airborne jumps were made. Now, it's certainly nice that they captured the, you know, bridges over the Yssel and what have you, but it may not have been as 100% necessary to do Varsity, considering that plunder had already succeeded.
Well, plunder was massive in itself. Yeah, they 4,000 artillery pieces fired for 4 hours, and in the U.S. sector, they fired 65,000 shells.
Wow! Yeah,
In an hour.
Well, they had the ammunition. Here's the another thing. You know, Montgomery comes in for criticism about over preparing, but he made good use of the advantages he had. He had overwhelming firepower. He had a preponderance of superiority in men and machines and material. He succeeded. And that, I think, is the critical thing.
He had a conscript army, and so perhaps to crack a nut with a sledgehammer is the way to do it, because you'd never not quite know the quality of all his troops. Some would be new to the field, some, you know, there'd be old hands. It's a very mixed bunch, is the Allied Army.
One of the things that you get, especially if you read some of the complaints made by some of the more aggressive, especially American commanders, talking about their own troops, or at least about, I should say, about American troops in general, as opposed to maybe their own division. So General James Gavin, he's the airborne commander of the 82nd Airborne Division, one of the better American divisional commanders. He would consistently say, you know, that the American troops are just not aggressive enough. The rank and file divisions. That being said, it was the winter time. It's miserable conditions. I'm certain that very few of these young soldiers wanted to be there. Okay, the war did look like it had been won. You know, maybe dying in the last few weeks of one war, that doesn't have much attraction to it. I do understand why maybe the idea that, all right, let's just, you know, keep going, advance the artillery. Oh, did we take fire from the Germans up ahead? Should we really charge them, or should we just ask for artillery to bombard their position? And, you know, and it maybe did make for a plotting style of warfare. On the other hand, you know, when you look at the losses that the U.S. incurred and also what the British 21st Army Group incurred, they were not especially heavy, all considering what was going on. They were, by and large, economical in terms of the lives of their troops. That doesn't mean that they didn't make mistakes. The Hurtgen battle was a disaster for the U.S. Army. For the most part, they were careful. And it's difficult for me to argue with what is success. And as I said, it's unrealistic to have expected them to have the war over by Christmas. So, and just to go back to another topic that you brought up earlier, the question of Ike's broad front strategy. You know, it's easy, the remove of, you know, many years, you know, once the war is over, to say, well, why couldn't the Anglo-Americans have been more daring, had a bolder stroke to, you know, encircle the Germans and wipe out them like a blitzkrieg against the Germans. And I think that the idea that we were going to blitzkrieg the Germans and wallop them in the West, it was not going to happen. What we saw with the Ardennes counteroffensive is that the Germans were consistently able to scrape together significant combat formations, and that any sort of, this daring narrow front operation would have been at great risk of being pinched off and circled by a German counterattack. And then you would have had a much bigger problem, much more losses than anything they actually incurred. Yeah.
And it's funny how we've almost portrayed it as a race to cross the Rhine. You know, they get the jump on Monty at Remagen, and Patton gets the jump on Monty again, and he's almost like this tortoise crossing over, but you know, his was still the key crossing. Patton's crossing came to nothing because they were not interested in pouring men over because they didn't want to bump into the Russians further south, I think. And then once they're over, it becomes no longer a race for Berlin. So again, the game changes once they're over, as the Russians are go to Berlin. So it's funny how it's sort of it's easy to see it as a race, but then it sort of accidentally is, as Monty's probably the tortoise to the American hares.
Montgomery comes in from various sources for criticism for being too plodding or too cautious, but you know, you have to understand that for years, the Germans were the past masters of, I'm going to call it Blitzkrieg, a term that the Germans wouldn't have used. Is, you know, Blitzkrieg was coined by this American journalist in the early part of the war. But the whole concept of motorized maneuver warfare, the Germans were very good at that. The Western Allies, less so. I think that Montgomery had a reason to be cautious, considering what had happened in North Africa and in other places where, you know, the German army had demonstrated that it was generally more capable of reacting quickly and making you pay for any sort of mistakes. Now, there's, you know, historians that will say that they should have realized by March of 1945 that the German army was just not capable of reacting as they had before. Thing is, the Allies didn't know that, the Allied commanders. They had already seen what had happened at Ardennes, and they had been completely shocked. The idea that there might be some other surprise waiting for them, that is not far-fetched. For example, one of the reasons why the Germans were able to mount such a powerful attack in the Ardennes in December 1944 was because they had withdrawn some of their most powerful formations from the Eastern Front, mainly the Waffen-SS, but also other units, and committed them in Belgium. In February of 1945, despite all the damage that had been inflicted on them in Ardennes, they still had 6th SS Panzer Army, which was used to fight the Russians around Budapest. Okay, that was, I want to say that was Operation Spring Awakening. Had there been some bold stroke, maybe, you know, Montgomery's 21st Army Group is given priority of supplies and they pour north, Hitler might have said, you know, the British are vulnerable, okay? We could use them against Montgomery. What might have happened had that army group been subjected to a powerful attack by this 6th SS Panzer Army? We can't say that's not how history turned out, but keeping a broad front, you know, ultimately, it was probably the safer course, all is said and done. And once again, they got everything that they needed to get. That is, you know, Berlin was going to be in the Soviet sector. There was no point in sacrificing British or American lives to take Berlin. They succeeded in what they did, and that, I think, it ought to be the end of that.
With the Rhine crossed, we'll leave it there. Thank you, Mark. Mark is a prolific writer, and if you're a keen reader of history magazines, I'm sure you'll bump into his work. If you're interested in the ancient world, his book, Rome Seizes the Trident, The Defeat of Carthaginian Sea Power and the Forging of the Roman Empire, is available now. I'll put a link on the website. If you're a supporter of the show via Patreon or PayPal, we have an extra 20 minutes of Mark and I chatting, and I hope you'll find that interesting. I'll release that today. Don't forget, if you would like to support the show, you can find out more at patreon.com/ww2podcast or go to ww2podcast.com for other options. So that's it for now. I think next time I'm back, we'll be looking at Alan Dulles and the US spy network operating out of Switzerland during the war. It's a topic we have touched upon before, but we'll look at in closer detail as a subject of German internal resistance and how much the Americans knew during the war, I think is interesting. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.